Thank you all for coming. I'm Jeffrey Leppendorf, Executive Director of the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses. Because I live here in Hudson, every year we do a literary festival here in Hudson. We also do them around the country, but this one's my favorite. I actually really mean that. I don't say that everywhere we have one. We have quite a lineup for you tonight. It's also the 10th anniversary of our Hudson Valley Literary Festival. Hudson is all lit up, so I hope you got some cake earlier over at the Opera House. If not, I'm sorry, we've eaten the cake, but we'll make up for it with some great literature. Our first reader is Joan Retallack, who I'm particularly delighted to introduce, and I've done something which is a terrible no-no, except I haven't really done it, because that would have been awful, but I'll tell you what I nearly did. The worst thing that anyone can do to a poet is to write them a poem and read it aloud. So I haven't done that. I'm not a poet, and I haven't written a poem for Joan. But I have produced something, and I'll tell you what it is and why I've done it. But I'll first tell you that Joan Retallack is a poet. Her books that's my favorite, the wonderfully titled memoir, is over there, so you can get your own copy if you don't have one. She's also equally wonderful as a literary critic, and has written extensively on people like John Cage and Gertrude Stein and others. And in a recent book, Music Cage, which is her conversations with John Cage, which is a really fantastic book, and particularly wonderful if you know Joan, and if you don't already, you will soon, that it is not Joan interviewing John Cage, but to me it's really a conversation between the two of them. So it's as much a book about Joan as it is about John. And, it, you know, close rhyme, it works out. But in the book, they speak a bit about John Cage's poetry, and he was known for writing what he called misostics, if I'm saying it right, even. Yeah. And which is a kind of a poem, they look kind of like this, that uses a mezzo text, a line of text or someone's name running down the middle of the page, and the poetry, which are called wing words, wrap around these mezzo letters. And the text is selected using some kind of procedure, and then there is still choice involved, but because I strictly followed a certain procedure, I feel like I've produced a little text, introduced Joan. So it's a misostic on Joan Retallack. And Joan can tell you what this means later, but it's a very strict 50% misostic. And you'll have to ask Joan what that means, but I could tell you later. And every line of text, and I was quite strict about it, comes from taking the letter's place in the alphabet and going on that page of her book, Music Cage, from the first page of the conversation, and selecting the first set of words that fit the rule. So I just produced this text. One of the things they discuss is the idea that all answers are answers to all questions. And Joan talks about that she had an idea of showing up to interview John with prepared answers or questions. I forget which way it went now. But it was going to be a set way of doing it.
Well, since they're interchangeable.
Since they're interchangeable, perhaps, that yeah, she would come. And John Cage was known for giving question and answers where he had answers prepared, and regardless of what was asked, he would give one of the prepared answers in order. And somehow they always kind of worked, which is amazing. And Joan talks about how she's taught classes using this method. So I'm now going to introduce Joan with a produced misostic on her own name using a strict rule that ran through the book. And I think it's kind of amazing. I take no credit. Okay. Just read from Wittgenstein, brushing the text, or no, Cage, one of which is intellectual and as far, whereas I, there, an odd way to have a conversation. We don't logically. It goes into life. All answers are answers to all questions. Antagonistic is not true, like the political nature of intuition. Joan Retallack.
Well, I truly feel it's all been said, but I'll go on. I thought actually the book that I'm about to read a couple of things from was the one that you were going to have here, so I apologize not having prepared something from memoir. Instead, I'm reading from Procedural Elegies, Western Civ continued, in which procedure, elegy, Western Civ, and continue all assume a variety of forms in the book. And I'm beginning with the epigraph for the entire book. Word ends where elegy begins, and vice versa. Now Jenny has everything. She performs every day and twice on Saturday. She is content, as the archaeology of our thought easily shows. Man is an invention of recent date, and one perhaps nearing its end. On this basis, modern positivism erected a pure methodology, purged, however, of the really interesting problems. Emptiness first registered the vibration that now charms and comforts and helps. I have thought that the bird makes the same noise differently. The sources for that are Sendak, Habermas, Foucault, Rilke, and Stein. And now I'm going to read just a couple of things from the long poem Western Civ Continued, which is entirely set in anachronistic real time. It begins with a conversational epigraph. And then Tortoise said to Hare, "Slow down, Bo Peep. We're all in this together, right?" Hare replied, "I think you've mistaken me for someone else, my good woman. Among other things, you've got the wrong story, the wrong gender, and the wrong species. I gotta go." "What other things?" cried Tortoise, as the horizon disappeared in a cloud of dust. Noticed disturbing grammatical construction among speakers engaged in breeding faster greyhounds. Meanwhile, 1794 CE, an Iroquois courier named Sharp Shins runs 90 miles across the hills of western New York in less time than it takes a classical tragedy to unfold, at a rate faster than it took Roger Bannister to run the first 4-minute mile. A blue ribbon team will be developing more broadly applications of the definition of death. In October 1989, she was quoted as saying, "This coup in Panama was unusual in its violence. These days, most things happen on the phone. Hi. Let's talk about this, okay? Zap, womp, gulp, you speak Esperanto? The better part of several hundred years might well have been devoted to depicting and re-depicting centaurs tormented by lust, myths of desperate adults become fairy tales about curious tots. Water, now up to second floor, just as she learns the great pre-Islamic poet, circa 600 CE, may have been a woman. Al-Kamsa replied, "I wear sidar because I was not aware of its prohibition." Water, now up to roof. Al-Kamsa wrote, "Walking slowly and seeming to bend forward every time I try to stand up straight." Breakdance lecture continued. "The truth is, I want to wear funny shoes and juggle while balancing a glass of water on my head. But I am not sure of the identity or the mechanics of that I. This would be an act beyond grammar, I suspect. like any referent in a life or death situation in which I don't believe what you're telling me, so what am I to do? As fear mounts, quotation marks drop like flies. None of this is my language, actually, just my arrangement of it. And maybe that solves the problem of I think, therefore, who the fuck do you think you are? The pronouns we inhabit for a while and then pass on to others, treat them well, stewards all. And yet I do at times feel frighteningly like a proper noun. Maybe that's the problem, the I don't want to not appear self-effacing but routine, don't get no one, nowhere, no how. This is agony, agonistic, agonizing, but fun. For word of wind, little trespass, Digby, 102. And then, actually, I'm going to change my glasses. Different font that I have more control over. and now I'll actually be able to see you. So I'm reading from a book manuscript that is just about finished, that's called The Reinvention of Truth, Fables, Moral Tales, and Other Awkward Constructions. And it begins with a section called Bosch Studies. These are very short prose poems. Fierce Love Story. To start with a taxonomic impediment and yet go on, looking always for news of another kind. Great saturated patches of color stall in their rumble toward the horizon. Squeeze tube dearth full of biblical pornography. Sit back and watch in awe as one sophisticated critter eviscerates another on the color-coded screen. No greater love, etc. Much too bright, or not enough to be convincing descriptions of nature. For the unconvinced, there are, however, the following consolations. One, sonorous cowboys hitch up primate dungarees. Two, to restore the consolation of silence will remain the role of objects. Three, a little girl, along with creatures of many improbable kinds, wanders in and out of the color field just beyond our grasp. The ventriloquist's dilemma. Birdsong entered our words and left with migratory echoes insufficiently dispersed. We are not designed to perceive most of what surrounds us or to fully understand the rest. Maybe it's true differential equations drove the teenager off the road. The self-propagating slope remains unhindered in its XY axis. Is this too absurd to attempt to state such things rigorously? Sound waves break on the shore, making one feel unwelcome. And, too, there's that conspicuous absence of real metaphor in nature. That conspicuous absence of real nature in metaphor. Someone will claim real is a misleading construct. Someone will claim night flew into a tree. Those five words in a line. Trans time. A question arises to play the sun in a dark little paragraph like this one now unfolding, in time to say hallelujah for that the experiment in time has already divulged its most monstrous fact. how it is or is it now, sooner or later, as Spinoza failed to say in his Ethics, that happiness being therefore dependent on the existence of other minds, sooner or later one must try to make sense of that fact too, the fact of trying together to make sense of fig one, just as fig two, divulging even stranger genitalia, rockets into view. Elliptical ice terriers. Just as our skates describe an icy metaphysic of parallel curves, I will be your personal pronoun for the duration of this sentence. You will be my personal pronoun for the duration of this sentence. It's all about remaining in motion, avoiding collision. Exquisite poetries and theories of everything propel axle jumps, backspins, no hands bicycle arias on the dark ride home. More radical alterity, more biomimicry, less blood sausage fealty, explosions of sweetest beauty. My child, why repeat what some poet or another has already? We live our lives forever taking leave. When a custom-fitted speech act can be yours within 24 hours. With it, you can perform rites and ceremonies, weddings, baptisms, funerals, forgiveness of sins, extreme unctions, visit correctional facilities, start your own church. Thank you.
Thanks so much, although now I suspect I as well, and I'm thrown into such an existential crisis, I think introducing our next reader will be difficult, but I'll try. You know, it's a great joy to have amongst four writers three that one has loved for a long, long time, and it's an equal joy to have one that one has just fallen in love with. I don't mean Leslie, I've just met her. I'm sure she's lovable, but I mean her work. Leslie Jameson's first novel, The Gin Closet, or I should say first book, published book, made some waves, but she has now come out with a second book that is a collection of essays, memoir, sort of essays. And I have to tell you, I can't wait to read the novel. I haven't read it, but the empathy exams, the essays are pretty damn stunning. It's hard to say more wonderful things about them. I will quote a line that Robert Polito quotes to give credit of someone else quoting a line from Leslie's own work. One reads them and crashes into wonder. They have a common theme of exploring the experience of empathy. And all of these essays, you read them and you think of all the things you might have felt and done in all your past actions, and you also learn how you might be a better person going forward. I'm going to ask Leslie to come up. I don't want to embarrass her, but I mean this. For those who have been wondering where Susan Sontag misplaced her mantle, I think I know who has it now. Leslie Jameson.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for that introduction, Jeff. I actually am starting to go a little bit gray in parts, which I should never say in front of a crowd, but I've been hoping that it would unite into one white band so that I can fully pick up the Sontag mantle. That was wonderful, Joan. Thank you. And it's such an honor to read with you and with Nick Flynn and Lydia Davis, both of whom I've been a fan of for a long time. So I thought that what I would do is read, like Jeff said, this new book is a collection of essays. And I'm actually going to read, most of them are a bit long to read in their entirety, but there are two collections of essays, triptychs of essays that I call pain tours. And the pain tours are interested in experiences, sort of structured experiences of other people's pain. So I look at various kinds of voyeurism. I go on a bus tour through gang territories in Los Angeles and write about that. I go into the deep underground bowels of Bolivian silver mines and write about that. And I'm both sort of troubled by what I see and also about what it means to be on a tour, seeing those things. And so I'm going to read one of the pain tours. But this pain tour is about a different kind of voyeurism, which is the voyeurism of being a writer and a reader. And this one's called The Broken Heart of James Agee. Many nights that autumn, I went to a bar where the floor was covered with peanut shells, and I drank, and I read James Agee. Liquor carried his vision of trauma all through me, twisted me pliable to the loss, and I wasn't afraid to think like this, pliable to the loss, because I was drunk, and drunk meant sentiment was not only permissible but imperative. It was boundless. Turns out, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men wasn't about famous men. It was about bedbugs and mildewed bridal caps and farmhouses like cracked nipples on the land. It was about how A.G. wanted to fuck one of the women he was writing about. Also, it was about guilt. Mainly, it was about guilt. Originally, it was a magazine article gone rogue. In 1936, Fortune magazine told A.G. to write a journalistic piece about sharecroppers in the Deep South, and he gave them a spiritual dark night of the soul instead. They rejected it. He wrote another 400 pages. It's a hard book to classify. It's got sections that don't seem to belong together, discussions of cotton prices and denim overalls and the soul as an angel nailed to a cross. It uses colons somewhat like this sentence does, rabidly. It's even better on the page. It's so long-winded and beautiful, you want to shake it by the bones of its gorgeous shoulders and make it stop. But the difficulty of closure is one of its obsessions, the endlessness of labor and hunger. It's trying to tell a story that won't end. I was trying, at the time I read it, to tell a story of my own. I'd recently returned to America after living in Nicaragua, where I'd been robbed and punched in the face one night, drunk. My nose had been broken, then partly fixed by an expensive surgeon in Los Angeles. I'd moved to New Haven, where it seemed like someone was always getting mugged. I was afraid to walk alone in the dark. Nearly all is cruelly stained, A.G. wrote, in the tensions of physical need. There's a notion we absorb about suffering that it should expand us, render us porous. But this didn't happen to me. I felt shrunk. Damage became fear. It became an assistance. I read A.G. thinking about his own guilt when he was supposed to be thinking about three Alabama families, and I thought about myself when I was supposed to be thinking about A.G. Or else, I thought of everyone who wasn't me, back on the streets of Granada. I thought of the boys I'd tutored some afternoons, glue-addicted and homeless with their runny noses and loose pants, catching them as they prowled the cantinas of Calle Calzada looking for money and company. I thought of Luis, who'd fallen asleep on the steps of the home where I lived, and how I hadn't invited him inside at night, only woken him up, nudged his shoulder because he was blocking the door. I inspected this memory for the shown seams of a moral. What should I have done? Maybe A.G. kept writing because he was looking for the stitching of a moral, too. Maybe that's why he couldn't stop. I loved getting sad about A.G. because his sadness wasn't mine. My face was claustrophobic and A.G. was something else. He was something I wasn't. Tragedy is second hand. Faulkner wrote that. Which meant, to me, families in Alabama hurt more than I ever would, and I could show up at a dingy bar and admit that. This wasn't enough, but it was something. A.G. felt this about his own book. It wasn't enough, but it was something. He writes of a woman's daily work in the cotton fields. How is it possible to be made clear enough, the many processes of wearying effort which make the shape of each one of her living days? How is it to be calculated, the number of times she has done these things, the number of times she is still to do them? How conceivably in words is it to be given as it is in actuality, the accumulated weight of these actions upon her, and what this accumulation has made of her body, and what it has made of her mind, and of her heart, and of her being? Empathy is contagion. A.G. catches it and passes it to us. He wants his words to stay in us as deepest and most iron anguish and guilt. They have stayed. They do stay. They catch as splinters still in the open, supplicating palms of this essay. If it were possible, A.G. claims, he wouldn't have used words at all. If I could do it, I'd do no writing at all here. In this way, we are prepared for the 400 pages of writing that follow. He says, a piece of the body torn out by the roots might be more to the point. A.G. doesn't offer actuality. He only wonders what this actuality might look like, an adequate description, what this accumulation has made, and suspends that possibility in the margins of his book. Everything he can't manage. On the question of poverty and its effect on consciousness, he is merciless. The brain is quietly drawn and quartered. His book does the same to its story, slicing it to pieces and putting it back together in fragments. The house, the dawn, the animals, the men, communism, children. He calls his work the effort to perceive simply the cruel radiance of what is. What is, it seems, was broken, so A.G. broke his book to fit. Subject holds structure in its thrall. Poverty pulls apart consciousness, dissolved into bodily necessity and stricture, and A.G. pulls apart narrative, drawn and quartered. He doesn't think he'll do his subjects justice. I feel sure in advance, he writes, that any efforts in what follows along the lines I have been speaking of will be failures. He chokes on his own words, interrupted by the commas and clauses of his apologies. He stutters here. He stutters often. I found it hard to talk about getting hurt. I kept trying to make it something larger than itself, that single moment in the street, to make it part of a pattern. The easiest pattern was guilt. My hand had been on a sleeping boy's shoulder, shaking him awake. What does concrete make you dream? I dream of that boy in circles. I dream of where my hand was. I could think forever about the man who hit me, how little he had, most likely, and how big a difference it might have made to him to sell my little digital camera wherever he sold my little digital camera, that camera I would have given him easily just to keep his hand from striking my face. A.G. went somewhere to look at poverty and tried to take the damage onto himself, to strip away its metaphors and get to some clean, torn truth beneath, the literal feeling by which the words, a broken heart, are no longer poetic, but are merely the most accurate possible description. What was broken in me that fall wasn't poetry. My face wasn't useful as metaphor or aperture. It was only the accurate description of where a hand had been. It doesn't seem right to say A.G. risked sentimentality. Better to say he could smell it from a mile off and clawed his way into it anyway. He thrust it before him like an obscenity, forcing everyone to see how his outrage had driven him to the embarrassment of such hyperbole. I felt infected by it. What good is guilt? A.G. asked. We ask. We like the sound of the question. It puts a crude finger on a heartbeat in us that won't stop racing, a pulse broken in sympathy. It makes us talk. It makes us talk about ourselves. It makes us confess. We want to purge something that even confession won't justify. That sleeping boy. A.G. drank when he wrote, and I drank when I read him. A.G. threw himself at the feet of his subjects, and I couldn't even bring myself to walk alone at night with my bone-broken nose and my vodka-flung and fluttering heart. You get drunk, and then you get sentimental, or else you get drunk and get hit. I told myself there was something dense and meaningful in my fear, an earned experience, the residue of contact, a cruel radiance, but truly there was nothing but my arms crossed over my chest as I walked on empty streets and no one coming after me in the dark.
Our next reader, Nick Flynn, who's both memoirist and poet, certainly wins the Meta Award for, this must be a very short list, surely there must be another, I don't know. Having written a memoir that was made into a film, and then writing a memoir about the experience of having his memoir made into a film. So we all here tonight may very well be the stuff of memoir, lucky us. Nick's going to read some poems, I think, and I'll just say a word about the book that you can get over there, the latest one. The Captain Asked for a Show of Hands. In a moment, I'm going to read one tiny little quatrain from it. This is really quite a wonderful book. For me, I found myself doing something I rarely do with a poetry book, which is that usually when I pick up a poetry book, I read the first poem. Always read the first poem first. And then I jump around, and if it's a great book of poems, I eventually read the whole thing. This one I read from front to back, and I think you need to. You can also jump around, I'm sure. I think it'll work, but it's really gripping. Nick takes head-on some very difficult subjects, and they sneak up on you, Abu Ghraib being the primary one. Speaking of empathy... finding the poetry in torture and pulling even more meaning out of some pretty awful acts. And for those of you that write poetry, I will say I recommend that you read the soliloquies in here, or the redacted soliloquies. I forget the exact name. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Because they're fantastic poems, and then Nick gives the full statements in the back of the book, which you can then read and go back and read them again. They're even better. So. I just want to read one little quatrain from a poem here, saudade, which is a great Portuguese word that Brazilians use all the time that is often translated as nostalgia, but it really suggests something more bittersweet and melancholy. It's an interesting way to remember things. And this is from the poem saudade. The tower towers above us. Now we can see it from wherever. It gives the impression we will never get lost. And this book really shows the way through some very difficult stuff in a very, very beautiful way. I think Nick is actually going to read from a new book, which comes out next summer. So you'll want to get this one now so that you have something to read until next summer. And can I give away the title? Because it's the best title of a poetry book ever. Or I can leave it for you. Okay. Nick also teaches poetry. And this title just is so great because it defies everything that any poetry teacher would ever tell a student. His new book is called My Feelings. To share some of his feelings, Nick Flynn.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for that, Jeffrey. I'm glad you said the title. I have a hard time saying the title. It's so great to be here with everybody. I mean, I'm really honored to be part of this reading, and all of you to be here, and also for CLMP, which is sort of one of the great things. I mean, poetry is, the thing about being a poet is that you know, it's supposed to have some nobility or something, you know, because you don't, you do it for no money, and you, you know, it's just, you just do it for the art, supposedly. Yet CLMP is actually one step more noble. I mean, they actually like publish the stuff, you know, and they you know support. They don't publish stuff. They support the people that publish the stuff, which is so important. The small literary magazines and presses, which is just so vital to this, to have any of the work that you heard, that you'll hear today, would not exist without CLMP. So I'm really happy to be here. So I'm going to read a few from this book, and then yeah. It's a new book, so I'm a little nervous reading from it. I don't know why I tell you that. I shouldn't tell you that. I shouldn't let you know that. And I've made a mistake. I've written the reading list in the back of the book, so I have to keep turning it over. I'm going to read from a few movie things first. There's a few movie references. This is from a movie called Beautiful, which is spelled wrong. Beautiful came out by Iñárritu a couple years ago. And there's also a moment in it where there's a topical thing in it, something that was in the news recently that I predict the outcome to, and yet it didn't come true. It's called The Incomprehensibility. The newly dead hung onto the ceiling last night like moths, wanting to tell us what they hadn't found words for yet, their bodies still warm on their mattresses below. They did not look comfortable, passing themselves on the way out. Only mystery allows us to live. Lorca wrote this on the back of one of his many drawings of a sailor, or of many sailors. Only mystery, and yet or so I pull myself back again to a place wherein I can comprehend, if only a glimmer, the moment my mother will press a bullet into the chamber of her 38. Think of Fra Angelico's annunciation. Nothing has happened, not yet. Mary's back is to the angel. His hand hovers over her shoulder, not touching her, not yet. It's still not too late to turn back. A Sunday morning, we can hear the ocean, we can smell it. If we could get up, we could even see it. Junkies can go to a clinic in downtown Vancouver now to shoot up in safety. We can help them find the vein, the pretty nurse says, but we cannot depress the plunger. As I write this, a Boeing 777, along with all 239 souls on board, vanishes from the sky. No distress call, no black box, no wreckage. By the time you read this, we'll all know what happened. That's the part I got wrong. Wormhole, drunk pilot. But right now, it is simply gone. Let's look again at the Annunciation. Let's think of the angel as a pretty nurse. Let's think of her wings as possibility, her silence as a syringe. Let's put my mother in that airplane now. Let's let her circle forever. Let's imagine she too is unable to land. She glances out the window, sometimes at the tops of the clouds, sometimes at someone's sad house below. I know you're still in there, she whispers, raising one finger. Poke a hole through the heavy curtains, she mouths. You'll see they're not even real. I'm going to read another movie one, just because I like movies. This one's called Gravity, based on a movie called Gravity, which a lot of people didn't like. I loved it. They were like, five movies that came out last year, they're exactly the same movie. Did anyone notice that? There was one, this Gravity movie, there was the one with Robert Redford on a sailboat, he's on a sailboat, and it's just him on a sailboat alone, and just drifting around. And then there's one with Tom Hanks on a boat, and he's just alone. Like, they're all exactly the same movie, the same script. You could actually, it's amazing, and I loved them all. Gravity. 5 days. I bring myself to movies in the middle of the day. Today, the movie is about an astronaut. That's all I know, all I want to know. I put on the glasses that make the world real, and soon the world is outer space. It starts with a view of the Earth, snow over oceans, brown land, all our thoughts from this. A space capsule drifting in darkness, some voices. So what do you like about being up here, a man asks. A woman answers, the silence. I could get used to the silence. For the past 5 days, the phone has rung in the still dark when I am still sleeping. Your father is in the hospital, one of the Creole women who takes care of him says, in her beautiful lilt. Soon, the astronauts, who are really little more than their voices, are caught in the debris of an exploding satellite, and everything falls away from them. Their spaceship, the Earth, each other. We can make him comfortable, the doctor says, if that's what you decide. I ask what pills he is on, and she lists many, many pills. To keep the depression out of his spacesuit, she says. These all have little titles, this Gravity. That was called 5 Days. It's called Meat. Today, as if answering a question only she could hear, my daughter declared, I know what little boys are made of. Little boys are made of meat. She looks into my mouth sometimes, says she wants silver teeth like mine. Why are your teeth silver, she asks. I want to tell her that there were a few years when I wasn't sure I wanted to be on the planet, until one by one, my teeth left me. Diamonds. That astronaut, when she finally decided to live, her tears floated around her head like diamonds. My favorite part, and I forgot it until just now. I think those are the only two movie references. So now I'll read, I have this 6-year-old daughter that, daughters cost a lot of money. And so I'm mining her. I'm just taking everything she says and putting it in poems. I'm determined to make it all back. This one's called Father Insect. After her bath, as a way to apologize for all my imperfections, I remind my daughter, you know, before you were born, I was not a father. She takes this in silently, moving a tiny blue elephant across the carpet. If you weren't a father, she eventually asks, then what were you, a bug? We'd been looking at pictures of cavemen, talking about evolution, about where we came from, about all those who came before. Are they us, she asks. I told her about the carbon in her pencil, about hydrogen bonding with oxygen, about bacteria with only one thought in their tiny heads. She used her finger to write it all out in the air, creating each word as I spoke it. When did want become more than hunger? When did need become more than shadow? Ecclesiastes warns about the making of books, of which there is no end. This chain of meaning, this offering, the book we both will write today into forever. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll go, we'll have a fun one now. Enough of the dark poems. Right, okay, then we'll have a dark one. I was only kidding about this one being a fun one, actually. This one's called Kafka. And the first line is, the cause of death seems to have been starvation. So, it's not really a fun one. Kafka. The cause of death seems to have been starvation. His throat closed, and so he was no longer able to swallow. On his deathbed, he was editing The Hunger Artist, which, perhaps ironically, perhaps not, he'd begun... Sorry. I have a clock, and then the phone just rang. So. I'm going to start again. Kafka. The cause of death seems to have been starvation. His throat closed, and so he was no longer able to swallow. On his deathbed, he was editing The Hunger Artist, which, perhaps ironically, perhaps not, he'd begun working on before he was felled. My father will, the doctor tells me, also starve to death. He also cannot swallow. I have said no to the feeding tube because I imagine that is what I would want someone to say for me, but really, how the fuck do I know? The fact that I am the one who will pull the plug on him and that I will pull it with one simple word is in the realm of the unbearable, but apparently I will bear it. The doctor promises to make him comfortable, which means morphine. Nowadays, this is how the plug is pulled. Afterward, all the money he buried under that tree, the take from his bank jobs, all of it will come to me, if I can just get him to draw me a map, if I can find the tree, if I can find a shovel. and the house, the mansion he grew up in. Soon a lawyer will pass a key across a walnut desk, but even this lawyer will not be able to tell me where this mansion is. And my father's masterpieces, his many novels, mine now to publish. I don't have to tell anyone I didn't write them, not a word. I'll read one more. I'll read this one. This is for James Agee, so. I mean, I just made it for James Agee now after hearing Leslie's piece, of course. It wasn't before, but now it is, if I can find it. Yeah, okay. I'll finish with this. It's called Alcoholism. Alcoholism. Once I fall from my stilts, once the elephant steps over my body, once a strong man tosses me and everyone like me into the hay, once I step out of my tiny car, once the enormous hammer crushes my tiny flowered hat, once I climb the rigging, once I leave the cannon, once sawdust becomes my sea. Below is the sawdust, below is the tent, below are the fires, below is the thirst. Inside the tent, an ox waits to be weighed. Not weighed, but to have its weight guessed. Guess the weight, win a prize. The prize is the ox. Every summer, they came to town, set up in the parking lot, a big tent raised up in the middle of the night, drove the stakes right into the tar. The men, a few women, tattooed and smoking, some missing teeth. A ride called the Caterpillar. It covered over at one point, so inside became utter dark. Kids lined up to shoot toy guns at cutout birds, tossed rings on impossible cones. I stood on the edge. I always stood on the edge. Looking across what I now call a rough patch, my chances less than average, as if wrapped in gauze, as if wading through molasses. There are those unfortunates, as if underwater, the sun and the voices, half measures availed us nothing. All this below me now, guess what thirst weighs, win a prize. If they said they would tie me to a chair, they tied me to a chair. If they found a dead bird, they put it on my lap. If they found a wasp nest, they put it on my head. If they found a cigarette, they pressed it to my thigh. They let a girl, retarded, behind the tent. Fire, fish, float, flower, fly, fog, freeze, and into the woods, put a stick inside her. The sound it made when it broke off. Give good grass, green, guts, hair, hand. When they said they were leaving me, they left. When they said they'd come back, they came back. When they asked if it hurt, I said. Years later, I fell in love with a sword swallower. Now, when we come to your town, we set up in fields, a field like every field. If it rained the night before, it shimmers. Pits of shimmer, I navigate home. Home, a trailer on the edge of a field. I hang up my face, she hangs up her sword. The ox is in a tent, the townspeople circle, cautious behind him in case he kicks, cautious in front in case he charges, in case he breaks the flimsy pen. Four boards tacked to four posts. A light shines in his black eye. One by one, children approach. Touch his side, their tiny hands. They know how the ox feels being touched. The barker holds a jar, some slips of paper. Guess his weight, win a prize. How can they guess? Take something you know, the barker says, a sack of flour. A cup is not enough. Imagine how many it would take to make an ox. The Ferris wheel stops at the top to let more on. I sway in my chair, the tent staked to the earth below. I used my hammer like everyone else. I am the one shot out of the cannon, every day at 3, this same face, this same cigarette, a tiny ember. I'm always on fire. I end the fucking show. Thanks.
Thank you, Nick. Before I introduce our last reader, I want to take a moment to thank Marianne and Michael for having us here. This is such a fantastic space to read in. It's so nice to not need a microphone and to have you all here and to have such a wonderful spread always. We've been doing this for a few years now, and it's just really nice to be able to return here. I'm doubly happy to introduce Lydia Davis, because she, in fact, is one of the very first readers we had here. So it's a little bit of a reunion for Hudson has all lit up to have her on our 10th anniversary for the Hudson Valley Literary Festival. I think when Lydia Davis's collected stories came out, we were all, who already read her, equally happy and sad, to put it simply. Happy that we had so much of her work in one place, and then sad to think that as a collected stories that she might be done. Luckily, she realized she wasn't, and we have Can't and Won't as the most recent collection, which we have here, so you can nab a copy. I think I don't have to tell you any of Lydia's credits. Surely you know that she won the Man Booker and Guggenheim's, and a long list of credits that if I were to read off would take up much more time than any of her stories. So I won't do that. But I do want to suggest that we think of Lydia as a master of the short story, but I think actually she is a Zen master, and there must be some other kind of title or special garment that she should have. You know, particularly here in Hudson, so many of us practice meditation and awareness, and it's really hard. But Lydia's got it down. And when you read one of her stories, you simply realize that you can be more aware of what is happening. I don't know what else to say, except, ladies and gentlemen, my great pleasure to introduce Lydia Davis.
Thanks, Jeff. I like that introduction. It's probably because I'm not very good at meditating, and I've read so many books about it without actually learning how to do it. But maybe that's, you know, if I really knew more about it, that would probably mean that I had... It would probably mean I'd actually understood how to do it. Anyway, it's very nice to be here and reading with the other readers. And in this building, it'd be a nice building to be trapped in with the wine and the books and the conversation, right? I'm going to read from the new book. And I, too, was a little distressed by the idea of having a collected come out. I thought, it does sound like the end. You know, it used to be that you didn't do that till you were 80, but I don't know. They can't think of what else to do. So I'm going to read from the new book, which, in my mind anyway, the stories seem to fall into different categories. And the first category would be called sort of just stories about ordinary life, more or less. The first is called A Story of Stolen Salamis. My son's Italian landlord in Brooklyn kept a shed out back in which he cured and smoked salamis. One night, in the midst of a wave of petty vandalism and theft, the shed was broken into and the salamis were taken. My son talked to his landlord about it the next day, commiserating over the vanished sausages. The landlord was resigned and philosophical, but corrected him. They were not sausages, they were salamis. Then the incident was written up in one of the city's more prominent magazines as an amusing and colorful urban incident. In the article, a reporter called the stolen goods sausages. My son showed the article to his landlord, who hadn't known about it. The landlord was interested and pleased that the magazine had seen fit to report the incident, but he added they weren't sausages, they were salamis. Circular story. On Wednesday mornings early, there is always a racket out there on the road. It wakes me up, and I always wonder what it is. It is always the trash collection truck picking up the trash. The truck comes every Wednesday morning early. It always wakes me up. I always wonder what it is. My sister and the Queen of England. for 50 years now, nag, 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 and harp, harp, harp. No matter what my sister did, it wasn't good enough for my mother or for my father either. She moved to England to get away and married an Englishman. And when he died, she married another Englishman. But that wasn't enough. Then she was awarded the Order of the British Empire. My parents flew over to England and watched from across the ballroom floor as my sister walked out there alone and stood and talked to the Queen of England. They were impressed. My mother told me in a letter that no one else receiving honors that day talked to the Queen as long as my sister did. I wasn't surprised because my sister has always been a great talker, no matter what the occasion. But when I asked my mother later what my sister was wearing, she didn't remember very well. White gloves and some kind of a tent, she said. Four Lords of Parliament had mentioned my sister in their maiden speeches because she had done so much for the disabled, and she treated the disabled, my mother said, like anyone else. She talked to her drivers the same way she talked to the Lords, and she talked to the Lords the same way she talked to the disabled. Everyone loved her, and no one minded that her house was a little untidy. My mother said the house was still untidy, and my sister was still letting her figure go. She invited too many people into her home, and she left the butter out all day. She told too much of her private business to her friend, the Indian grocer on the corner, and she wouldn't stop talking. But my mother and father felt they had to keep quiet because how could they say anything against her now? She had done so much good and was so admired. I'm proud of my sister and I'm happy for her because of the award, but I'm also happy that my mother and father have finally been silenced for a while and will let her alone for a while, though I don't think it will be for long. And I'm sorry it took the Queen of England to do it. Negative emotions. A well-meaning teacher, inspired by a text he had been reading, once sent all the other teachers in his school a message about negative emotions. The message consisted entirely of advice quoted from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. Emotion, said the monk, is like a storm. It stays for a while and then it goes. Upon perceiving the emotion like a coming storm, one should put oneself in a stable position. One should sit or lie down. One should focus on one's abdomen. One should focus specifically on the area just below one's navel and practice mindful breathing. If one can identify the emotion as an emotion, it may then be easier to handle. The other teachers were puzzled. They did not understand why their colleague had sent them a message about negative emotions. They resented the message, and they resented their colleague. They thought he was accusing them of having negative emotions and needing advice about how to handle them. Some of them were, in fact, angry. The teachers did not choose to regard their anger as a coming storm. They did not focus on their abdomens. They did not focus on the area just below their navels. Instead, they wrote back immediately, declaring that because they did not understand why he had sent it, his message had filled them with negative emotions. They told him that it would take a lot of practice for them to get over the negative emotions caused by his message. But they went on, they did not intend to do this practice. Far from being troubled by their negative emotions, they said, they, in fact, liked having negative emotions, particularly about him and his message. The next story I'm going to read is one of several letters of complaint in the book. The letters of complaint that I had started... years ago, I'd written a letter of complaint about the word cremains to a funeral parlor. And I actually did eventually send the letter in a slightly different form. Never got an answer to it. But it made me realize how much I enjoyed complaining. A lot to complain about, and I enjoyed writing very articulate letters of complaint to various people, rarely getting an answer. So there are 5 letters of complaint in this book, and they actually allowed me to figure out how to organize it, because there are something like 123 stories in here. So I just decided to make 5 sections, each of which would have a letter of complaint, and then that helped me divide all the other stories appropriately. So this one is one of the, I think it's the shortest one, called Letter to a Frozen Peas Manufacturer. Dear Frozen Peas Manufacturer, we are writing to you because we feel that the peas illustrated on your package of frozen peas are most unattractive color. We are referring to the 16-ounce plastic package that shows 3 or 4 pods, one of them split open, with peas rolling out near them. The peas are a dull yellow-green, more the color of pea soup than fresh peas, and nothing like the actual color of your peas, which are a nice dark green, nice bright dark green. The depicted peas are, moreover, about 3 times the size of the actual peas inside the package, which, together with their dull color, makes them even less appealing. They appear to be past their maturity and mealy in texture. Additionally, the color of your illustrated peas contrasts poorly with the color of the lettering and other decoration on your package, which is an almost harsh neon green. We have compared your depiction of peas to that of other frozen peas packages, and yours is by far the least appealing. Most food manufacturers depict food on their packaging that is more attractive than the food inside, and therefore deceptive. You are doing the opposite. You are falsely representing your peas as less attractive than they actually are. We enjoy your peas and do not want your business to suffer. Please reconsider your art. Yours sincerely. And that's, I think, maybe the only letter of complaint that actually did receive an answer. It turned out that Cascadian Farms was owned by General Mills, and it was General Mills that sent me not really an answer to my letter properly, but a coupon for Jolly Green Giant peas. I probably should have just kept it going and written another letter saying you ignored my first letter and sent me coupons for another brand, which I do not want to eat. Maybe I'll still do that. It's been years, though. I'm going to read last a set of the very shortest stories, if I can call them that. There's, you know, a lot of debate in my mind whether I can call them that, but I can't think of a better solution, so I still do call them that. When I was translating Proust, which I did for several years, one book took a long time, there wasn't much time to do any of my own writing, and I did want to keep writing in some way or other. And I reacted to his very long sentences, which sometimes went on for pages, by seeing how short a piece I could write. I was already writing fairly short pieces anyway, but I wanted to see what the actual smallest piece possibly would be that I could write. I've since read others by other people that are even shorter. There's one, I think it's by the Scottish poet Edwin Morgan. If anyone knows that I'm wrong or right, you can say so. I hadn't even known his name, but he turns out to be enormously important for Scottish literature. And he had written a poem called Homage to Zukovsky that consists just of the whole text, or the body of the poem, is the word "the." So you need to know about Zukovsky's huge book called A, to understand the. So I'll read some of these. Bloomington. Now that I've been here for a little while, I can say with confidence that I've never been here before. Contingency versus necessity. He could be our dog, but he is not our dog. So he barks at us. Contingency versus necessity. Two, on vacation. He could be my husband, but he is not my husband. He is her husband. And so he takes her picture, not mine, as she stands in her flowered beach outfit in front of the old fortress. Her geography, Alabama. She thinks for a moment that Alabama is a city in Georgia. It is called Alabama, Georgia. The language of the telephone company. The trouble you reported recently is now working properly. Housekeeping observation. Under all this dirt, the floor is really very clean. Judgment. Into how small a space the word judgment can be compressed. It must fit inside the brain of a ladybug as she, before my eyes, makes a decision. Her geography, Illinois. She knows she is in Chicago, but she does not yet realize that she is in Illinois. Her birthday, 105 years old. She wouldn't be alive today even if she hadn't died. Last one, PhD. All these years, I thought I had a PhD, but I do not have a PhD.
Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you next year. Have some cheese. Thank you.